Chapter 1. Lake Lucerne, Switzerland. August 5th, 2006. Kate dropped into the lake without a sound. Still under the surface, she kicked away from the boat's stern, disappearing into a long, dark alley that twisted between the other boats. Ethan followed nearly a minute later, returning to the surface in the shadows as quietly as he went in. He checked to see if the people beside their boat had noticed, but everyone on deck was looking at the long, feathery streaks of a golden fire fading from the evening sky. Not a soul on any of the hundreds of boats surrounding them cared about what happened in the black waters below. The lake beyond the boats was choppy. A cold summer breeze blew in from the Alps. The light of the pale, smoky moon was too faint to let him find Kate. He saw her only when the sky lit up in a blaze of white light, a silhouette against the shimmering surface of the water. Kate had already stripped down to her wetsuit and was applying night camouflage to her face when he joined her. Scissor kicking lazily to keep her head above water, she seemed like a beautiful lady before her mirror. Ethan studied her features while he stripped his own clothes away. Her face was striking, a pleasant mix of feminine delicacy and aristocratic boldness. Eyebrows, nose and jaw were prominent and refined. It was a face cameras loved. The curve of her eyelids and sweet, round fullness of her lips missed cute by an eyelash. Her laughter had mischief and music. Her sweetness came with passion, her fury with anger. Descended from bastard English royalty on both sides, married and widowed to an English lord, she was tall and blonde, brilliant and connected, ambitious for risk and all things new. She could plot with the patience of an older woman scorned, and then take what she wanted with the speed of an urchin. They had met some years ago, by pure chance, or so it had seemed to him at the time. He learned later that Kate was a woman who got exactly what she wanted and left nothing to chance. He had been with two other climbers in the Alps. They had hauled their equipment toward a fairly difficult rock, planning to spend the day ascending it. Kate was by herself, with only a liter of water and a sweatshirt at her waist. She approached them while they were still preparing their lines and laying out the pitons. Without saying a word, though indulging herself with a look of casual interest in Ethan's lean, muscular physique, she had started climbing. Ethan watched her for a moment before starting after her. It was his first climb without ropes, but he hardly recognized the danger. In fact, all he thought about was the woman ascending the rocks above him with the agility of a lioness. Even though he had considered himself in peak condition, he could not catch her. "You climb without ropes much?" she had asked when he had finally joined her at the summit. He ran his hand through his short dark hair and smiled sheepishly. "First time." He had a pronounced Tennessee accent in those days. Instead of putting her off, as it did with a lot of the Europeans, she seemed actually to enjoy it. "Is it going to be your last?" She asked this with curiosity and a bit of a dare in her expression. Ethan could still remember grinning and shaking his head. It had been the most exhilarating climb of his life. "I hope not." "Kate Kenyon," she said, and shook his hand. The following morning, they had headed toward the Tyrolean Alps, hitchhiking when they could, catching buses or trains otherwise. One afternoon, as they clung to a tiny ridge of stone, probably 1,000 feet above a field of boulders, Kate had said to him, "Think we could make a living doing this?" Ethan thought she meant as professional climbers and laughed at her. She could make a living, but he was a long way from her level. In another few days, he would be heading back to the States to start law school at George Washington. All this and Kate Kenyon, nothing more than a pleasant memory. But she wasn't talking about rocks. "A joke," she told him that night as they lay together in bed. But it was a joke that did not go away. Why did he have to go back? She could go with him, he said. And do what? Anything. Anything at all. "We could do that here," she had answered. Two evenings before his flight, following what had promised to be their last climb, they were walking under a wall in Como, when she laughed and said to him, "Come on." A moment later, she disappeared into a darkened estate. Ethan knew what she meant to do. He knew, too, the smart thing was to walk away. But walking away wasn't really an option. He followed her over and had the thrill of his life, stealing a lady's necklace and making love on a stranger's silk sheets. He had been following Kate over walls ever since. Nothing at all intimidated her. She came alive at the point where even the most courageous would hesitate. She loved risk as others loved adoration or money or notoriety. If it was possible, she would try it. If it wasn't, she would try to figure out a way to make it so. Physically, her conditioning and strength could still astonish him. A golden palm tree etched itself against the black sky, the firework holding its form until the last glowing embers blinked away. As soon as it did, a staccato of heavy explosions boomed across the lake. From the boats huddled together at the center of the lake, a collective sigh drifted toward them. "Ready, boy?" Finishing his face and his memories of those first weeks with Kate, Ethan dropped the tin and pulled on his skullcap. "Ready, girl?" Like it was just another job. They swam with only the top of their heads breaking the surface, moving quickly toward the dark peninsula closest to them. From time to time, Kate would roll quietly and look behind them, never breaking her forward momentum. The only time Ethan looked back, he saw the light of a police patrol boat moving along one of the distant shorelines. Once past the peninsula, they waded through a shallow marsh. Deep in the mud and weeds, they found their inflatable, a Sea Eagle 9.2. It was exactly as they had left it the night before, well camouflaged and loaded with their equipment. They had stolen it 6 weeks before because it was light, easily handled, and quick enough to get them to the other end of the lake and back. While Kate cleared the brush away, Ethan inflated the keel and checked the pressure in the other chambers. Taking the grab lines, they lugged it toward the water, jumping in just as the craft cleared the marsh. Ethan dropped the 10-horsepower motor into position and pressed the ignition. The Honda purred quietly to life, and he steered the craft away from the shoreline. Over the next 3 minutes, they worked their way past three large estates. The great houses were darkened, apparently empty, easy targets but of no interest tonight. They pushed on and finally came to a small, densely wooded hill. One lone mansion occupied the crest of it. To either side of the property, for nearly a quarter of a mile in either direction, there were no other houses, no lights, no roads. Just as the land began to rise up sharply, they glided into shore. Kate jumped out first and pulled the raft over a stretch of gravel, while Ethan heaved out their equipment. Wading back into the lake with their gear in a watertight bag, they swam another 50 yards or so, coming to a piece of grey rock that rose up almost vertically over the lake. Kate took the equipment and swam ashore. Ethan veered off toward the estate's private dock. This was secured by a high stone wall and closed off with a set of steel gates. It offered one large boathouse, built as a replica of the main house. In one of the two berths beneath it sat a luxurious Fountain 48 express cruiser. In the second was a Pantera 28, the fastest boat on the lake. Two jet skis were tied next to the Pantera. There were no lights on in the boathouse or around the dock. The perimeter was protected electronically. The slightest movement would trip both an alarm and security lights. Taking the bicycle chain lock latched around his waist, Ethan keyed it open and slipped under the surface. Close to the dock's entrance, he reached out blindly until he touched the moss-covered steel bars. Snapping the lock closed, he dropped the key and swept back from the gate. He returned to the surface and swam back to Kate. She had already set out their gear in neat his and hers piles. Before he did anything else, he took a towel and began drying himself. Still in his wetsuit, he slipped on a cobra vest. Next, he put on a pair of black pants and a matching jacket. Finally, he slipped on a pair of black sport socks and his climbing shoes. Both the pants and jacket had been specially modified by a seamstress in Milan Kate used for all her jobs. Every object and tool they would need had a reinforced slot to hold it tightly against the body. He inventoried each as he slipped it into place, reviewing the various points within Kate's plan. A silent whistle, a pair of thin leather gloves, handcuffs, a couple of lengths of rope, a small, flat steel crowbar, a Navy Colt 45 semi-automatic pistol with silencer attached, the first round already in the chamber, a combat knife, a small flashlight, a climbing pick, and a concussion hand grenade in case things went to hell. When these were in place, Ethan reached for a small backpack with a dart rifle attached. The pack fastened to his body snugly and offered a small ripcord neatly tucked away. One tug and a canopy would snap open. He could access the dart rifle simply by reaching behind his head. He finished with a full hood, night vision goggles, and a headset. Kate began working over the tarp and rope with one of the towels. Together, they dragged the tarp to the water, throwing the towels after it. As these sank into darkness, Kate whispered into her headset, "Ready too?" Ethan heard the second team's response, two voices answering in sequence, "Ready one." Kate turned to Ethan. "Ready, boy?" Ethan gave a slight nod of his head. "Ready, girl." Kate walked up close to the rock and tipped her head back, planning her ascent one last time. Ethan did the same, even though he had studied the rock a number of times from the lake. The stratification was typical of the area. It offered finger and toe holds all the way to the top. At about 45 feet, a good third of the climb finished, the rock tilted, allowing for a rest if he needed it. He was plotting his next move when he saw Kate start up the rock. She took the first 10 feet in half as many seconds. Ethan had made more than a dozen practice climbs under these conditions on a far more difficult rock. When Kate ran a job, she was nothing if not thorough, but they had used pitons and rope for night training. This was his first free climb in the dark, and it left him a bit uneasy as he began. Hazarding a glance in Kate's direction after he had started up the rock, he saw her passing the midway point. He listened a moment and caught the steady rhythms of her breath. His own methodical plodding embarrassed him suddenly, and Ethan pushed himself to emulate his partner. Never a smart thing to do. When he looked down, the distance was perfect for getting himself killed. Too close for him to get to his ripcord in time, too far even to think about a lucky fall. He could see exactly the rock that was going to kill him, too. Angrily, Ethan stepped up his pace. He reminded himself just how easy this rock was. He moved quickly now for several steps, pushing off one fingerhold and reaching for the next without pausing to consider, or to test, or even to think, exactly as Kate climbed. Stopping at last, if only to understand his progress, Ethan felt his nerves betray him. He began to reach for his next hold, but then hesitated. Kate was waiting just under the top of the cliff and watching him now. Could she see he was getting into trouble? Hear it in his breathing? He made a long reach and found himself unable to catch a decent toehold. He pulled back and probed more carefully. Nothing. He looked down at his rock and felt his hands beginning to sweat. All he could think about was a climb in the Burgle Valley some years earlier. The rock had frightened him before he began. About halfway up, fighting at every inch of the way, his fingers had suddenly released their hold as if they had a mind of their own. It happened sometimes when a climber was tense or frustrated or scared. If you were wearing a harness, you could kick away and hang quietly until you got your focus back. In a free climb, you were dead. For a moment, he could not bring himself to let go with his left hand. It was the same thing that had happened on that day. First the muscles locked up, then the fingers opened. Still clutching the rock, Ethan brushed his toe over the stone until he found a small crevice. It was not sufficient to hold him, only to take some of the weight out of his fingers. He looked now for another ledge, and realized his left hand had begun to cramp. Taking his weight into his toes, he finally broke free with his hand and tried to shake the blood back into it. As he did this, he stretched his left leg out, going for a fresh toehold, and almost fell when a cramp struck his hip. This was the point when you kicked out and laughed, trusting to your ground person and the rope. You lost, the rock won. Maybe you tried again tomorrow. Maybe you took up hiking. He heard Kate now. "Get left. You've got a decent shelf not more than 10 feet away." Ethan tried looking for it. "Trust me, it's there. Get to it now. Take your time, but do it. Don't think about it." It was not what she said, but the fact that she was there, that she understood he was in trouble. Ethan focused on her voice with that faint, soft, feminine British accent. He forgot his feet, his cramp, his fingers. forgot death itself. Your left foot is on it, boy. A little higher. Good. He pulled himself higher, stepping into a thin shelf, and found another fingerhold, nothing more than a pocket within the stone. His hands felt soft. The cramp in his hip faded. He shook his hands, but it was only habit. The blood was flowing, his strength returning. And then he found himself directly opposite Kate, both of them just under the edge of the cliff. "I thought I was going to lose you," she whispered. "Cramps," he said. "They don't ask how, they just ask how far down. Are you good now?"
"I'm good."
"Team two, we are in place. Repeat, we are in place." The Palace Hotel, Lucerne. From the rooftop of the Palace Hotel, Sir Julian Corbeau pulled his gaze from the explosion of colour in the sky over Lucerne and fixed his eyes upon the Contessa Claudia de Medici, a slender, middle-aged woman, standing close to the parapet. She had been in the country almost 2 decades without once venturing out to a social gathering of this sort. Corbeau wondered why she had finally relented. It wasn't a fondness for fireworks, he was sure of that. The bankers never failed to invite her, of course. But it was only a matter of form. Her sole extravagance was her annual party for 100 or so of Switzerland's social elite. Everyone Corbeau knew attended it. It was, they like to say, the party of the year, littered with luminaries from around the world. When they had begun, Corbeau's troubles in America had created something of a scandal, and that may have been the reason she had overlooked him. But more recently, as America bashing had become something more than just posturing, Julian Corbeau had enjoyed a burgeoning reputation in Europe. To be positively vain about it, Sir Julian was fashionable again. And still she had not extended an invitation. He could not, of course, approach her directly like some blushing schoolboy anxious for her attention. He would not give her the satisfaction. He mingled with others. He talked about politics and society, as one does. He even talked briefly about a business venture with a French concern. Eventually, the Contessa's name came up. The famous parties she threw. Hadn't he been to one of them? No, Corbeau answered. In fact, he said, he had been under the impression she was Jewish. A bit of surprise at this. Not at all. My mistake, Corbeau answered with a slight smile, noticing with satisfaction the sudden doubt in the other's face.
Worth I don't know how many million, the gentleman offered, as if that might make up for failings of the blood.
Certainly not the Demetri family.
Married a poor cousin, I believe. A careful, thoughtful sip of champagne. Got a title for her troubles, as I understand it. I believe she brought the money into the marriage, however.
Divorced, then?
I really don't know. She's very mysterious about her private life. I think he might have died, come to think of it.
Any idea how she came by her money?
I'm not sure, but I'll vouch for this. She has plenty of it.
As the man who was speaking to him at the moment happened to be an officer in one of Switzerland's leading banks, Corbeau was quite sure of the Contessa's bona fides. In fact, he had rarely seen such passion in a Swiss banker's eyes.
And yet one never sees her,
Corbeau offered, as if baffled by her failure to embrace Swiss society.
Really, I'd say, shy of publicity mostly. When she accepted this evening, she wanted assurances there would be no cameras.
I wonder why.
If you can believe it, I think she is a genuinely humble person.
I was under the impression that humility had gone out of style.
The banker laughed politely.
An extraordinary woman, by all accounts. May I introduce you?
She had lovely eyes, the Contessa. So much so that one hardly noticed she refused to extend her hand. I've heard a great deal about you, she said in French, though she was not French. The dusky skin and cool dark eyes intimated a far older race. She wore an exquisite ruby at her neck, in a setting that looked to be a skilful imitation of jewellery from the Roman Empire, if not an original. Instead of a wedding band, the Contessa de Medici wore an extraordinary antique cameo ring. It depicted two lovers holding hands. It might have been a Baroque fantasy of Arcadia, worth how many hundreds of thousands, one could only guess, but Corbeau was inclined to believe it was an original, worth closer to 1 million. Corbeau's response to her courtesy was humorously self-effacing, a skill he had learned only with great difficulty.
"One should never listen to rumors. They are always so painfully accurate."
"Rumors are all I can afford. You see, my work keeps me too busy to get out much."
"You mustn't be a slave to your work. Life is to be lived."
"I am a slave to my passion, Sir Julian, which is scholarship."
"The Contessa is an author of some repute," the banker remarked in a well-schooled French that sounded like a pale imitation compared to the Contessa's.
"The Forgotten Jerusalem," Corbeau answered, using the English title. "I believe it is the finest book I've ever read on the Roman occupation in the first century."
"Have you read a great deal of history, Sir Julian?"
"Not much of value, I'm afraid, but more than most people, I'm sure. Books happen to be my passion. Of course, I still manage to find time for the occasional evening with friends, so perhaps my passion is not as all-consuming as it ought to be." The banker, playing his part, explained that Corbeau possessed what was widely regarded as the finest private collection of occult literature in all of Europe. With a faint smile to soften her obvious distaste for him, she asked, "Are you a magician, then?" It was a question Julian Corbeau generally despised. The Contessa, however, seemed to understand what she was asking. Certainly she was a woman who knew the difference between parlor tricks and the work of a true magus.
"I don't believe in nonsense."
"Perhaps I should have said adept."
"That's another matter altogether. Unfortunately, I'm nothing more than an amateur. I enjoy reading about men and women with true occult powers, but that is my limit. I'm not sure what I would command of a spirit if I could in fact conjure one."
"And I was under the impression that you are a man who knows exactly what he wants. You'll excuse me."
"Extraordinary woman," the banker observed as the Contessa walked away.
Flushing angrily, Corbeau did not bother answering the fool. Extraordinary she was, but there was something more to her than that. Corbeau knew hundreds of extraordinary people. It was his business to know extraordinary people. This one was different.
This one had no fear of him. Lake Lucerne. They put on their gloves as they waited for the second team to respond. For a moment there was no answer, and Kate repeated herself a third time. "Team one in place, do you read?"
An old man's voice answered, "Almost there, girl." His voice came again after repeat, "On target." Kate and Ethan began moving. A moment before they came off the rock and took hold of the retaining wall, floodlights washed over the entire property. A long, wailing siren broke the silence. This was followed by several sharp blasts of a horn and a trill of electronic bleats. Over his headset, Ethan heard a woman cursing in a rustic German dialect.
"Who put the gate in the middle of the road?"
The man soothed her. "We made a wrong turn, sweetheart." They were talking loudly, their windows rolled down so their slurring voices might carry to the guardhouse.
"I did not make a wrong turn," the woman answered angrily. "Someone put a gate in the road."
It was a well-rehearsed script. Two drunken Austrian tourists on a summer evening, with their fender pushed against the front gate of a millionaire's estate and making it clear that the accident was entirely the property owner's fault. Meanwhile, Kate and Ethan scrambled off the face of the cliff and moved into the shadows to each side of the property. They crouched in a shooter's tripod, one knee touching the earth, their dart rifles drawn and ready. For a moment, nothing happened, and they were able to study the property for the first time up close. The house looked like a castle holding the high ground, but that was something of an illusion. Only the tower on the lakeside was actually medieval in its design. The house, though over a century old, was built for comfort. A large terrace opened off several glass doors at the ground level. Above this was a columned balcony, offering yet another view to the lake. The property was nicely sheltered to either side by a small forest. It was secured by high stone walls, except at the back of the property, where a vertical face of rock reached down to the lake and prohibited all but the most intrepid trespassers. The lawn stretched out perhaps 70 yards from the house to the edge of the cliff. At the centre of it was a small concrete helicopter pad. Otherwise the area was open and green, giving a view to the lake and mountains beyond. Along each wall, a gardener had indulged himself some years ago by planting numerous flowering shrubs and low, well-trimmed fruit trees.
These presently kept the area closest to the wall in virtual darkness, even when the security lights were shining, and provided a natural screen against anyone looking out from within the house or monitoring the property with cameras. Chances were no one was looking at the back of the property. Kate had created too much interest with her scripted drama at the front gate. In his headset, Ethan could hear two car doors opening and closing. The sirens stopped abruptly. The lights remained on. "I suppose you're going to stand there in your fancy uniform and say this is my fault," the old woman was talking to a single guard. They knew the owner of the estate was in town, a VIP guest at the Palace Hotel's rooftop party during the city's annual fireworks. If all went well, the five men assigned to his personal security would be with him. Two guards remained at the estate. With one at the driveway, the second would be in contact with the police, hopefully informing them that at the moment there appeared to be no reason for assistance. That left the two dogs for Kate and Ethan. They had come out of their kennels with the first alarm. Like the guards, they were focused on the situation at the front gate. When Kate blew her silent whistle, they came to a slight rise of land and looked anxiously for the source of the whistle. They were not inclined to leave the excitement at the front for less likely prospects here, but they were curious. "Dogs are coming," Kate whispered. Ethan could not hear the sound, but both dogs did. They began running at the same instant, bounding almost playfully at first, not quite sure where to go. When they had covered about half the distance between the house and Kate, they seemed to locate her. As soon as they did, they flattened down in full attack. Ethan blew his whistle, and the dog closest to him changed course without breaking stride. Dropping his gun sights into the dog's dark mass, Ethan squeezed the trigger. The Doberman flinched, tumbled, and then somehow got to its feet again, its hind legs kicking wildly as it struggled to continue the attack. Ethan dropped the dart rifle and pulled his knife as the animal lunged, but the drug had dulled its reactions. It fell short of him with a grunt and slid through the wet grass. The dog kicked once, trying to get up, then groaned like a man in his bed and fell back for a long sleep. Ethan looked across at Kate. She was already pulling her dog by the skin of its neck into the thick foliage. Putting his knife back into its sheath, Ethan dragged his dog into the shadows, dropped his goggles into place, and started along the wall toward the house. Meanwhile, the drama at the front gate continued. They wanted to see the owner. They weren't leaving until this was settled. When he was nearly to the house, Ethan heard Kate. "Ready, boy?"
"Ready, girl."
They cut across the lawn toward the terrace from either wall. A long loop of climbing rope hung over Kate's shoulder like a bandolier. They met under the house. Kate slowed her pace as she stepped first on Ethan's thigh, then his shoulder. Letting her momentum carry her up, she reached the second-story balcony guttering, kicked once, and scrambled to safety. From there she could throw her rope and grappling hook toward the tower roof. Meanwhile, it was Ethan's job to neutralize the second guard if Team 2 could not take him down. He drew his Colt and moved toward the corner of the house, leading with a quick peek. A uniformed guard walked out of the guardhouse and ambled lazily toward the trouble at the front gate.
Ethan pulled back into the shadows. Team 2 had drawn both men.
The woman signaled this fact with her slurred speech. "And you? What do you want?" "I said I wanted to speak to the owner of this dump. I don't need another uniform in my face." Her husband tried again to calm her. "They were just working a job like everyone else," he said. "She shouldn't be cursing these poor fellows." The second guard spoke in the same crisp, high German as his partner. They were on private property. They were going to have to back up and leave unless they wanted to be arrested. Did they want to be arrested? Did they insist on going to jail for the night? There was no answer. Nothing at all but the indistinct sound of two darts spitting out of two pistols simultaneously. Then Ethan heard the sound of two bodies hitting gravel. Kate and Ethan had 20 minutes, give or take, more than twice the time Kate had said they would use. Looking up, he saw Kate walking up the side of the tower, her rope stretching down from the roof. He pulled the flat crowbar from the sheath on his thigh. At the French doors of the terrace, he broke in with a single twist of his wrist. The lights were on inside the house. He returned his crowbar to its sheath. Moving from room to room with his back close to the wall, Ethan swept his handgun sights into the empty spaces. He heard in his headset Team 2's leader, "Two sleeping at the gate. We're off." The connection went dead. Ethan finished sweeping the ground floor and began up the grand stairway. At the landing, he heard a muffled explosion, both on his headset and directly overhead. Kate was taking out the top of the tower with Czech Semtex. Ethan worked from room to room on the second floor, quick and dirty just to be sure. Kate had drilled him on this part. The house should be empty, but they had to assume the worst. An overnight guest, a guard they didn't know about, Corbeau changing his plans. She called it the catastrophe factor. In the main hall again, Ethan walked down a narrow corridor. This, according to the plans of the house they had stolen from the city planner's office some months ago, would take him to the library and tower. "Coming in, girl," he said. He kicked through the locked door and found a beautiful room. Along two of its vast walls were built-in bookshelves. The third wall offered a bank of windows with a view to the lake and a large, perfectly arranged writing table. The fourth wall had a set of pocket doors at the center. These were presently closed. Each door offered three cast-iron ornaments, fashioned into the likeness of small black ravens. They appeared to function as door handles or some kind of medieval locking mechanism. From what he knew of their man, Ethan didn't trust them. He thought they might be booby-trapped, something gothic, mechanical, and deadly. "House is clear," Ethan said, "but stay away from the doors. I don't like the look of them." "We're on the clock, boy," Kate answered.
7 minutes, he said.
5 is better.
The Palace Hotel, Lucerne.
Geoffrey Bremer, Corbeau's director of security, stepped out of the shadows and signalled his employer. Corbeau excused himself and walked toward the man with a bit of curiosity. Bremer usually handled his job without involving Corbeau.
"What is it?" he asked.
"A couple of drunks at the front gate set off the alarm." Corbeau looked out across the lake. He disliked any sort of disturbance that was not of his own making. Officially, he was still a U.S. fugitive. The U.S. could not act against him because he was under Swiss protection, but that didn't mean bounty hunters wouldn't try it. The U.S. attorney, in a fit of pique when Corbeau had jumped bail after his indictment, had offered a $1 million bounty to anyone capable of delivering him to a government willing to extradite him. That meant getting him out of Switzerland. In 11 years, two different groups had been foolish enough to try it. Austrians, apparently, a man and a woman, 60-something. They've been instructed to leave, but they're not cooperating.
Notify the police to be on standby and give them one more warning.
I'll take care of it. As he watched Bremer depart, cell phone to his ear, a strange dread took hold of Corbeau. It was not the first time the feeling had hit him. On 3 separate occasions over the past 2 weeks, a wave of nausea had washed over him. His instincts told him his enemies were closer than he knew, but he could not locate the source. He had persuaded himself it was nothing, but nothing was suddenly becoming very insistent. Instinctively, he searched the rooftop, looking for the Contessa. She was gone. A camera spotted, no doubt. He looked at the crowd. There were very few strange faces. Of those he didn't know, he saw no one capable of successfully spiriting him out of the country. It was possible that was the plan, of course, but it was more likely something was going on at the house that was not quite what it seemed. Well, the police were alerted. The road could be closed down in a matter of minutes. Everything should be... Bremer returned. He made no signal this time. Corbeau understood the look and immediately walked toward him. "I'm getting no response at the guardhouse. What about the police?"
"They are sealing off the road."
"Good. Nothing more. I want to take care of this myself."
Bremer's smile suggested just how much he loved his work. "I thought you might. The SUV should be at the front door by the time we get there. The second team is already moving. They should be at the house in 3 minutes." Lake Lucerne. Ethan went first to the bookshelves, checking the titles out of curiosity. Not surprisingly, given the man they were robbing, most of the library was devoted to the esoteric. He saw Pietro Mora's Zecherboni, a 17th century treatise on magic, that he knew had been found in Casanova's possession and was instrumental in getting the famed lover convicted of sorcery in 1755. He saw Aleister Crowley's Confessions and fought the impulse to pick it from the shelves. He was sure it was a first edition. Crowley, at the height of his powers in the early 20th century, was known as the wickedest man alive. He saw Madame Blavatsky's Isis, the complete works of John Dee, Dion Fortune's Through the Gates of Death,
Eliphas Levi's Masterworks on Magic in the original French, Le Dôme et Rituel de la Haute Magie and Histoire de la Magie. He saw Robert Flood, W. E. Butler, Alice Bailey, Albertus Magnus, Pietro de Albano, Pappus, Rudolf Steiner, and on and on. The library itself, book by book, if he could haul it out, was worth several million dollars on the open market. But tonight it was not part of the plan. Tonight they wanted one painting, if it even existed. He moved to the second wall, which included biographies and secondary matter related to magic. Hiding in plain view. He scanned the shelves, looking for anything that might conceal a small panel painting. Anything? Kate asked.
Not yet.
There's nothing in here.
Check the masonry. We're close. I can feel it.
What I can feel is we're running out of time.
We're okay.
He broke the lock on the desk with his crowbar and felt a twinge of guilt at the destruction of such a beautiful piece. Inside the only drawer, he found a Mont Blanc and pale cream-coloured stationery embossed with Corbeau's coat of arms featuring a raven in flight. Beneath it were the words Gare le Corbeau. He looked at the two pictures on the wall separating the library from the tower. One of them was a faded print of a young girl, maybe 9 or 10 years old, sitting naked in an antique graveyard on what appeared to be her shroud. Her eyes were opened wide in apparent surprise at finding herself alive again. It was framed in a delicate grey. The framer had accented the grey with a thin, faded vermilion line. Penciled in a tiny script was the phrase, "Nothing but the beautiful is true," followed by initials and a date, O.W., March 29th, 1899. "We have the right man," he said, and felt his pulse kick up. O.W., Oscar Wilde. He had been here a century ago. To see it again? Summoned? Gentleman that he was, Oscar had brought a gift. Something to commemorate their first meeting? What Ethan wouldn't give to know that story. "We're running out of time, boy." Ethan turned from the print to the painting, a small dark landscape of Golgotha after the execution. He walked toward it. It was a primitive black-on-grey study of the crucifixion scene after the bodies had been taken down and the crowd had gone home. Ethan reached out carefully to touch the thing. The frame stayed tight against the wall. Checking more closely, he saw a tiny hinge behind the frame. When he pulled on it harder, the edge of the painting came off the wall like a small door opening. Inside, he found a recessed metal lever. Ethan pulled it, but nothing happened. Next, he tried turning it. The mechanism worked, but again, nothing happened. A booby trap? He looked at the raven heads on the pocket doors. No. The door handles provided the only trap Corbeau needed. This was the way in. The Knights Templar had used three empty crosses to indicate the treasure, or possibly the key to the treasure, or even the place of concealment, depending on the context. It was not a symbolism widely recognized beyond Templar enthusiasts. The raven, on the other hand, was the essential ornament on Corbeau's coat of arms, underscored by the words Gare le Corbeau. Beware the raven. He tried pulling the lever in its new position and discovered to his surprise the pocket doors began to slide back. Kate stood in the darkened room, her night vision goggles in place over her hood. She pulled these up and let them rest on her forehead as she stepped into the library. Ethan showed her the handle, the painting, and the print of the young girl. "Look at the initials." "Oscar Wilde," she said. "Maybe he took it." "It's here, girl. It's the Corbeau family heirloom." Ethan stepped into the gloomy tower. There were no light fixtures, no electrical outlets, only candelabras with half-burnt candles set about the room. The room itself was a perfect circle. On the floor, in a mosaic, Ethan recognized the Grand Seal of Solomon. The letters of magical words were all written in a Greek script. Kate's climbing rope lay coiled upon it. It stretched up through the broken ceiling some 12 feet overhead. Before the explosion, there had been a ceiling painting. Most of it was gone, but Ethan could make out that it was the traditional occultist's Tree of Life, with the 10 emanations of God, each named in Greek letters.
"There's nothing here," Kate whispered.
For the first time, she sounded anxious. Her burglar's heart had an internal clock. Ethan studied the empty room. He saw the Masonic eye of God. Before it were two small marble pillars. A plain stone altar had been placed neatly between them. He walked around the room, examining the stone benches built into the wall. Where would they keep the paraphernalia? He studied the seal of Solomon. We have to go. It's here. Doesn't matter. We're out of time. Ethan walked across the floor, scrutinizing the intricate patterns and letters. He was looking for a telltale crack in the stone. He pulled his flashlight and began walking the circle of the seal. The stone had been laid over a century ago. There were tiny fissures and a bit of yellowing, but that was all. Kate spoke again. Time! Ethan looked toward the altar again. He focused on the eye. Was the eye staring at it? He spun around and looked at the wall, then walked toward it, shining his flashlight. Nothing. He went back to the library and touched the painting of the empty crosses. Which was it? The treasure? The key to the treasure? Or the place of concealment? Kate took his arm. Now, she said. Ethan pulled his knife and began cutting along the edge of the canvas. 1 minute, then we go. She checked her watch. Nothing appeared behind the canvas, so the painting was the key. He tried to turn the handle, but it did not move. He pushed it back into the wall, and the pocket doors began sliding together. He watched until the doors came together, and then turned the handle as he had before. Pulling it out again, he watched the doors begin to open. While they were still moving, he tried turning the handle. This time he got something. The lever snapped easily to a new position. The doors continued to open, but the wainscoting along the lower part of the wall slipped down behind the baseboard, revealing three shelves. On the top, he saw a skull and crossbones sitting on a piece of white linen. The linen was wrapped around a small, flat, rectangular object. This is it, he said. Slipping the packet out from under the bones, Ethan hurriedly unfolded the cloth and came face to face with the portrait of Christ that was painted, if the legends could be trusted, inside Herod's palace in Jerusalem at the order of the prefect of Judea, Pontius Pilate. According to the oldest reference to the relic, anyone who looked upon it would live forever and never grow old. The Templars had thought it inspired visions. Let's go, boy! Ethan slipped the panel into a waterproof pouch and tucked it into the metal frame between Kate's back and backpack. Having any visions yet? He asked. I'm seeing trouble. Then we'd better go. A man appeared at the door to the library as Ethan said this. He was wearing a tuxedo and carrying a semi-automatic pistol in his right hand with the casualness of someone holding a drink. He was tall and trim, somewhere in his mid-30s. He did not seem especially surprised to find two intruders wearing black silk hoods inside Julian Corbeau's library. In fact, he seemed to expect it. Kate reached for her pistol as Ethan drew his own gun, but they were both responding. The man was ready and appeared remarkably relaxed as he pointed his pistol at Kate and shot her. Kate kicked back under the impact of the bullet as Ethan's Colt cleared its holster. The man turned his weapon calmly toward Ethan and fired again. This time he missed. Kate's weapon fired from the floor simultaneously, and the man in the tuxedo fell back against the door. A split second later, Ethan's Colt fired, striking the man's neck as he went down. Ethan stooped down to check on Kate, whose smoking gun was still pointing toward the door. He found the bullet hole over her heart. I'm okay, I think, she groaned. Ethan probed the opening and discovered a hot, flattened piece of lead. Gotta love the cobra, he whispered. Kate came slowly up to her feet. Together they looked at the dead man sprawled against the door. Where did he come from? I don't know, but if he has friends... They heard voices calling in German from the stairway. Two? Three? Ethan could not tell, and did not look forward to finding out. We're in trouble, she whispered. You get out with the painting. He pointed toward the rope. I'll keep them busy. Ethan walked to the doorway of the library, stripping his silencer off his navy Colt. He grabbed the dead man's weapon in his left hand. A voice called up the stairs in German. Did you get them? Ethan looked back and saw Kate staring at him. Go, he hissed. I'll meet you downstairs. It was a lie. Probably the last thing he would ever say to her. It didn't matter, though. The problem now was getting Kate out alive. All he had to do was live long enough to give her a chance. She could take care of the rest. He went down the tiny corridor fearlessly. He could not remember ever having such certainty or courage. Kate's life depended on him now, and what he could do in the next few seconds. That was all that mattered.
Two men in tuxedos on the stairway fired their guns simultaneously as Ethan rolled forward across the hall. He came up on one knee with both guns leveled on them and fired the weapons successively. One man went down under the barrage, the second pulled back. Another voice called from below. He heard footsteps ascending the stairs and came back to his feet, his retreat cut off. That was when Kate came out and began firing her Navy Colt without the silencer. One of the men screamed. The others fell back. Ethan fired two shots as he crossed the open area and came back into the tight corridor.
"Go," he told her. "I'll hold them until you're out."
He turned out and fired three more shots to keep the men back while Kate ran to the tower. Pulling his grenade, he slipped the pin and dropped it in the tight confines of the narrow corridor. Kate was nearly out of the tower when Ethan took the rope and began climbing it with a rapid hand-over-hand. He heard the voices of two men as they came up the stairs. The grenade exploded before they got to it, but it slowed them down enough for Ethan to get to the roof. He pulled himself out with the help of his climbing pick. Kate, covering him, dropped her own grenade into the tower and pulled the rope out. She reset the grappling hook and began down the side of the tower. Ethan watched the yard as she did, but no one came outside. He heard the grenade inside the tower explode just as he dropped off the roof and began rappelling down the tower. On the ground, Ethan scrambled toward the wall. The lights in the house went off, and a volley of automatic weapon fire poured from three points along the ground floor. AK-47s, Kate whispered in the aftermath of the sustained burst. As the next volley began, a man sprinted out of the house and moved quickly into the shadows of the wall opposite them.
"One in the yard," Ethan said, moving carefully back until he found a tree and a rock that would give him something more than just concealment. "I'm going to draw his fire."
He fired blindly at the house once. As he did, the gunman in the yard responded with a long volley. Mulch and dirt blew into his face. Splinters of stone stung his neck and hands. As soon as the gunman opened fire, Kate responded with three quick shots at his position. A scream of pain ended it, and then Kate was running for the cliff. Ethan began squeezing off rounds toward the muzzle blasts inside the house. He continued firing until he was standing and moving across the brightly lit field. He fired until his ammunition was gone, then dropped both weapons and sprinted for the cliff. Kate went over, her modified parachute blowing out behind her. Ethan got nearly 2 seconds of silence for his efforts, but then the automatic weapons began again. His legs felt heavy and uncooperative. The ground ripped crazily before him. He heard small cracking sounds as the bullets passed by his head. Logically, he knew he could cross the 25 yards in a matter of 3 or 4 seconds. Without cover, with automatic fire from two weapons bearing down, the final 2 seconds seemed like 10. He fell once, rolling back to his feet. Then his legs betraying him, he staggered toward the edge of the cliff. He touched the ripcord a step before he went over, exactly as he and Kate had practiced it. He felt the heat of one bullet pass him as he pulled the cord, and he knew with a sudden exhilaration he had made it. That was when his back lit up in pain. Instead of jumping as Kate had done, Ethan grunted at the impact and stumbled over the retaining wall. He heard the parachute open with a snap and felt the drag of it pull him upright. It let him drift out toward the water without his assistance.
His night vision goggles still resting on his head, he saw nothing before he plunged into the lake.
He waited for his body's buoyancy to take him to the surface, then fought free of the ropes and canopy. He tasted the lake water and nearly went under again before he wrestled free. He searched for the gunman at the top of the cliff. All he saw was a mass of rock and the night sky. They would be heading for the boats. A flash of light across the water caught his attention, and he whispered, "Do you see me?" There was no answer. He had lost his headset and goggles when he hit the water. He whistled, failing miserably, then found his flashlight and signaled once, hesitated, then twice more. Kate flashed her light once, and Ethan heard the outboard motor purr. He looked up toward the top of the cliff again. Still empty. Kate brought the raft to him and leaned over with her hand held out. He took her wrist and the grab line. Rearing up out of the water, he fell across the raft. Corbeau could hear them pulling away with a small outboard motor as he climbed aboard his cruiser. He signaled Bremer toward one of the jet skis and pressed the keypad by the pilot's wheel to open the gates of the dock. The cruiser's triple engines roared to life, but the gates did not move.
"Open the gates!" he shouted.
Bremer pulled forward and tried the keypad. "Jammed!" he called.
Corbo swore angrily and killed the motor. "Call the police!"
While Bremer spoke on the phone, Corbo cursed his folly and paced the deck. For days he had been waiting for another attempted kidnap, never imagining the real danger. And now it was too late.